Renaissance, a French word meaning rebirth or revival. The Renaissance, those centuries following the Middle Ages when the arts, science, commerce, and innovation flourished. Renaissance, Act One, the seventh studio album of Beyoncé Knowles Carter, emerging from the darkness of the pandemic as an innovative sonic exploration of humanity, independence, love, sexuality, and possibility.
Now I just fell in love, and I just quit my job. I'm gonna find no drive, damn, they worked me so damn hard.
This album reflects a new maturity and exploratory playfulness for Beyoncé. Its 15 tracks have a kind of mixtape quality, blending from one to the next.
I'm one of one. I'm number one. Wait, I hear you just got paid making rain.
So go ahead and disable the random shuffle on your music player, because this album is meant to be experienced in order. And in that way, it harkens back to an era of vinyl albums and 8-tracks when artists made their offerings as wholes, whose sums were greater than their parts. And like the European Renaissance of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, Beyoncé's new album draws on foundational traditions to make something new, grounding itself in dancehall, house, techno, and Afrobeat. And yeah, we're going to talk about the fact that she bounced this one too. Joining me now is Monica Perkonte. She's a music journalist and staff writer at Rolling Stone. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Monica Per.
Hey, Melissa. Great to be here with you.
Do you have a favorite track?
Do I have a single favorite track? No. Do I have like a top 4 or 5? I could even narrow it down to a 3 for you.
All right, let's hear it.
All right, so the songs that immediately like grabbed me upon my first listen are the ones that tap into like African sonics. So I'm Sierra Leonean, as you know. And so the music that I grew up with just always speaks to my heart. And so I hear it in energy.
Yeah. Ooh, 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 pick a side. Only double lines we cross is dollar signs. Yeah.
I hear it in Move. There's like an Afro house quality to those songs, and so I love that about them.
It's the way you wear your emotions on both of your sleeves.
I love Plastic Off the Sofa because Beyoncé is just like the queen of love songs, and they're like, there's romance on this album, there's love on this album for sure, but there's really just like this like unmitigated joy, and Plastic Off the Sofa, I think, combines those elements of the album really, really well. It's so pretty. It's floating. There's a part where her voice just like flutters across the track, and it's one of my favorite songs to listen to on the album as well.
As you're describing Plastic Off the Sofa a bit, I feel like you're capturing some of, you know, certainly what I've seen in social media in terms of how folks are initially responding to the particularities of this album. When you talk about the vocals, talk to me a little bit about what you're hearing and how Beyoncé is using her voice this time.
I think that there's such a sense of play on this album. And I think that she's having just a great time, like zeroing in on all the magnificent things that she can do with her voice. There's the singing, right? Which is like beautiful. It can be really light. It can be like grave and like powerful. But then also she's screaming like unheated.
Turn me off, my wrist goes click. Dimples on my hips, stretch marks on my. Drinking my water, minding my biz. Monday I'm overrated, Tuesday on my.
Which is written by Drake. And if you're a Drake fan, you can tell like in the first half of the song, it really sounds like something like things that Drake might say or melodies that he might use. But in the second half, she's rapping and it sounds like really almost like primal, like it's coming from the depths of her. And so I think that she's utilizing her voice, of course, and as a technically talented singer, but also just as like a really personal means of expression.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about your immediate attraction to the tracks that sound like home for you? So for me, the moment that like I cranked in the car while I was listening was once we got to Break My Soul and Church Girl. And the ways that Beyoncé in those tracks with Big Frida, with Church Girl, is bouncing her music, is bouncing her songs. And I think in a similar way, I'm responding there to the New Orleans that sounds like home to me.
Yeah. And that makes perfect sense. Before you even said, as soon as you said sounds like home, I was like, she's going to talk about Church Girl. And Beyoncé is just so good with all different types of music. And I think that one thing that's really impressive is no matter what she's playing or exploring, it all sounds very authentic to her.
That's a good point. I mean, you know, she gave us on Lemonade, she gave us a little country, right? And was reminding us of the country roots of Black folks and the Black roots of country music. What are some of the roots you see her tying into here?
So she didn't get into big detail about the influence that her Uncle Johnny had had on her. But we know that from her website, she had talked about the influence of a family member exposing her to the types of music that we're hearing on Renaissance. And so a lot of that, you know, is like house music. She's pulling from 90s club, like underground club music with the Pure Honeys samples.
All the pretty boys to the floor. Get your money, 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 money. Don't be funny with my money, honey.
Amois Renee and Kevin Aviance, who were queer influencers in like the truest sense, like influencing music, influencing a scene in the 90s. She is also, you know, pulling from disco. Beyoncé's always pulled from funk. And I feel like we're hearing some of that here. Like you mentioned earlier, you know, there's like these electronic elements that she's playing with. And I think that all of it comes together so beautifully in the sequencing, in the transitions, even though she's going from era to era across dance music, which is a huge umbrella, it feels very whole.
We're gonna take a quick break. More on Beyoncé's Renaissance, Act One, coming up here on The Takeaway.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with you on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. I've been speaking with music journalist Magapur Kante about Beyoncé's new album, Renaissance. All right, let's talk about some of the controversies surrounding the album. First, the album was leaked, but then the leak didn't go nearly as far as you might think a leak might. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was certainly surprised that the album has leaked. You know, for the at least the past decade, Beyoncé has been the queen of surprises. It seems like she runs a really, really tight ship. Of course, there were physical releases of this album that might have complicated protecting the source material, but I was definitely surprised to see that the album had leaked, but I was not super surprised to see that in like my little corner of the internet, people were not willing to talk very openly about listening to the leak, even if they had. So like Twitter just unveiled like a close friends sort of application. And I saw some people here and there mentioning that they were listening to the leak, but only to people that they trusted. And so, but widely people waited to discuss the content of the album until the actual release date. And I think that speaks to the way that a lot of us really respect Beyoncé's artistry, knowing that there's a way that she intended for this album to be received and to be processed. And folks wanted to honor that. I think it's partially fear and I think it's partially respect.
All right, let's talk about Khalees and Milkshake, a song that is sampled in Beyoncé's Energy. Khalees says that that for all of the crediting that she did and all of the releasing that she didn't credit Khalees's songwriting here. What's going on here?
So Khalees has spoken out about feeling misled and undervalued in the way that her rights were attributed to her, or not attributed to her, rather, by Pharrell and Star Trek, the label that she was signed to for a point in time. And so her disappointment and her anger seems to come from the fact that, one, she was not credited properly, but then two, you know, was not even approached by Beyonce or people in Beyonce's camp to be informed that her music was going to be used, or that they would have liked to use some of Milkshake on Renaissance. And I think that one of the things that's been really important to me is to hold and respect both women. So I think that we can respect Beyonce's artistry, the amount of collaboration on Renaissance, how beautiful it came out, and also know that, you know, someone may have been harmed in the process and may have, you know, felt hurt, betrayed, what have you, and that both of those things are legitimate and we should be able to hold them at the same time.
We've talked about the vocals from a kind of sonic perspective, but there's also the lyrics. Beyonce is doing some fairly political work at various points, even from the beginning, right? Even from I'm That Girl. Talk to me about what you read as the politics of this album.
I think that there is really a deep investment in personal freedom on this album, from Church Girl saying, you know, no one can judge me but me, in the context of a song steeped in religious imagery and Christian imagery, and knowing that maybe people under that belief system might say, well, no one can judge me but God. I think that Beyonce calls herself a God. She encourages the people who are listening to Renaissance to think of themselves as God. There's very few instances of pain across the album. There's so much investment in hope and possibility and in personal freedom. You know, the world has been really crazy. And I think that it's important for us to think communally and collectively. And I think that in the way that Beyonce is communicating the importance of that is like thinking about the world like a dance floor, like thinking about the world like a club where we're all together, we're enjoying ourselves, our bodies are moving and pulsing at the same rate. I hear a collective spirit in Renaissance, but I also definitely hear a politic of personal freedom too.
Yeah, which makes it quite different than Lemonade, right? It makes it different than Formation, than Black Parade, than the halftime show, you know, dressed as Panthers. It does feel more individualistic. And I'll say, you and I have a relationship that goes way back on talking about Beyonce. And one of the critiques that you raised early for me of Beyonce's music was this question of individualism versus the communal. Does this feel like a return to individualism, or is it a spin on it? Is it a different way of thinking about individualism?
Of course, there's a lot of like flexing about material things, about beauty, about things that we might see on the surface. But I think that the personal freedom that I hear Beyonce encouraging us to explore on Renaissance is so deeply about being in tune with your body, being in tune with the people that make you feel good about yourself, about feeling good about yourself. And I think that that feels a little different than, you know, let's all go be Black Bill Gates.
I'll never forget you saying that. I mean, it's also worth saying that, you know, when we hear a 20-something, you know, young woman talking about how beautiful and sexy she is, it is different than a 40-year-old woman who's had three children, including a fairly difficult second pregnancy with twins, right? For her to make a reclamation of her body, right, does have a different gender politics to it and a different sort of positionality.
Yeah, I mean, there's a line, I want to say it's on Heated, where she talks about having stretch marks on her breasts, and she's not like hiding under this like false guise of perfection. It's like, what I hear on Renaissance is I am whole and I am flawed and I am still a God in spite of or because of all those things.
Since I've got you here, I just want to ask you about a fellow Houstonian. You penned the cover story for the June Rolling Stone in conversation with Megan Thee Stallion. Can you tell me a little bit about the experience of writing that extraordinarily personal piece about that artist?
Thank you. that was definitely one of my favorite and like most treasured writing experiences thus far. I spent a lot of time with Megan. We did an escape room in LA. We went to the studio in Miami. We talked over Zoom. And I really honored the opportunity to tell the story about someone who a lot of people might feel like a part of. You know, so many of us watch Megan come up from ciphers to superstardom. But she also is her own person that is going through a really, really difficult time in her life and that has dealt with unimaginable violence, you know, a lot of loss. And so just being able to tell that story in a way that answers the questions that so many of us have about how she's doing and how she's feeling, but also capturing the little like fun, joyful, the breadth of idiosyncrasies that make her who she is, what she likes to eat, how she likes to play. That was really one of the best writing experiences I've had so far.
Mongabur Kanté is music journalist and staff writer at Rolling Stone. And she's been my interlocutor about Beyoncé for nearly a decade now. Thanks so much for being here, Mongabur.
Thank you so much for having me.